Good morning. Well, my name is Brian. I don't know all of you. It's such a pleasure and an honor, and I'm humbled to be preaching this morning. I made the mistake of putting a picture of a new tattoo on Instagram. I got a tattoo of Mary singing in the Magnificat from this passage, and our pastor said, "Oh, you like that passage, huh? Would you like to preach on it?" So just be careful what you put on social media. She's watching. You could be up here next. Just a fair warning to all of you. But I want to thank you so much. Over the past 2 weeks, my family has actually been quarantined. We all got COVID after Thanksgiving. We're all better now. We're all past our quarantine. But over the last 2 weeks, many of you delivered our family meals. So I want to say thank you to Anne for that amazing tomato soup, Brenda for the chicken and rice soup, Rosine for that Pakistani dish. You guys were all very, very kind. And so we have been really refreshed by belonging to this church, even just for the past few months. I do love this passage. I find it one of the most beautiful and powerful in the whole Bible. So I do feel honored to talk to you a little bit about Mary's song this morning. Last week, Melissa spoke about Mary and Elizabeth meeting together and Elizabeth speaking a blessing over Mary in her house. And at that moment, after Elizabeth speaks this blessing over Mary, an interesting thing happens. Mary breaks into song. Yes, the book of Luke is actually a musical. I love musicals. We recently saw Encanto as a family. Very fun, highly recommended. Some people think musicals are corny. I respectfully disagree, but I understand where they're coming from because musicals can be very on the nose, right? There's usually this part at the beginning of the movie where the main character just kind of sings their feelings. Like they kind of just spell it out for you what's going on internally. Like Ariel sings, "I want to be a part of that world." Or, you know, Mulan sings, "When will my reflection show who I am inside?" And it kind of just hits you over the head narratively. It's not very subtle, musicals. But it's actually very convenient for screenwriters, right? Because they can sort of just have the characters explain what's going on without sort of having to draw it out with sort of subtle narrative clues and that sort of thing. Like if you want to know what's going on with Belle, well, she wants more than this provincial life. And Gaston, he wants to make Belle his wife, right? We know what everybody's on about. They just sang it for you. They just spell it out for you. And here at the beginning of the book of Luke, rather than explain with sort of subtle narrative clues what the birth of Jesus is all about, Luke just really helpfully has a character sing it for us. We don't have to scratch our heads and wonder. It takes all the guesswork right out of it. We can just listen to this song. But I actually find the content of it a little bit surprising. You know, based on what we know about Christmas and church culture and Christian doctrine, if I were going to write a musical number to sort of unpack the big idea behind what's going on here with the birth of Jesus, I would probably write it about the mystery of the incarnation, you know, the second person of the Trinity entering into human flesh, the eternal Son taking on humanity. And that's a big part of what this story is about, but that doesn't actually come up in Mary's song at all. Instead, this song is Mary's dynamic, insightful commentary on what God is up to in all of this and what that shows us about what God really cares about and about whose side God is really on. Dietrich Bonhoeffer said that this is the most passionate, most vehement, one might almost say most revolutionary Advent hymn ever sung. None of the sweet, sugary, or childish tones that we often find in our Christmas hymns, but a hard, strong, uncompromising song of bringing down rulers from thrones and humbling the lords of this world. He says, these are the tones of the prophetic women of the Old Testament, Deborah, Judith, Miriam, coming alive in the mouth of Mary. But Mary stands up and her dynamic song gives a voice to voiceless people. In the story that Susan read just a moment ago from the book of Judges, which has obvious echoes of Mary's story, the mother of Samson in that story is not even given a name. She's just referred to as the wife of Manoah. We learn the father's name, but not the mother's name. All we learn about her is that she was barren. And this is typical of biblical women because of the nature of the patriarchal world that they inhabited. And like that unnamed woman and like Hagar and like Sarah before her, Mary also receives a divine promise of a son. But I'm so glad that Luke doesn't keep Mary in the margins. Not only do we hear her voice in this passage, this is actually the longest set of words spoken by a woman in the New Testament. And Mary is not confined to speaking about issues of childbirth or fertility. No, she speaks prophetically and theologically, and she actually, in this song, challenges the very core of the worldly system that we live in, and she calls us to a new way to live in the world. And so let's look at this song for a few minutes. She starts by acknowledging the unexpected favor that God has shown her. She says, "My soul magnifies the Lord, for he has looked with favor on the lowliness of his servant." And Mary was certainly lowly. She was a teenage girl in a small town, far away from the places of power. Nazareth, where she lived, was at the bottom of the totem pole of important places, and teenage girls were at the bottom of the totem pole of important people in Nazareth. But Mary rejoices in this moment because she recognizes that God's eyes were not on the supposedly important places. God's eyes were not on the palaces in Rome or on even the temple in Jerusalem. God's eyes were ultimately on her, on little old Mary. And this is worth singing about because, of course, that is the opposite of the way that the world works. Mary's world, just like our world, was structured around a hierarchy of power and privilege. You had religious purity, family heritage, land ownership, vocation, ethnicity, gender, education, age. These were the components that made you a worthwhile person. And Mary basically struck out in every single one of those categories. And so the surprise that evokes this praise, this wonder, this glorifying and magnifying God is that she recognizes that God seems to care most about the people that the world cares about least. God's eyes focus on exactly the people that our eyes tend to gloss over. Mary was overlooked in her world, but she's realizing that she was never overlooked in God's world. I love the lyrics of that song we just sang, "God of Every Daughter." The way that it captures the feeling of being overlooked, of being unseen, of being unheard. But the good news of the gospel that we just sang is that no daughter is unheard by God or unseen by God. In fact, God is a God who especially sees those who go unseen by the world. And so the writer of Judges may not have mentioned Samson's mother's name, but the story of Mary teaches us that God especially knew her name. And this is a theme in the book of Luke. I'm reminded of the parable of the rich man and Lazarus that Jesus will tell later in Luke 16, where the rich man, who had all the markers of status, and he walks past this poor beggar every day without so much as a glance at him, without even acknowledging his humanity. It is this rich man who has no name in the story, while Lazarus is given a name. God knows the names of the people that we don't care to know. And God seems to ignore the name of this rich man that people in his day would have bent over backwards to know, to get into his good graces. God doesn't care about his good graces at all. See, Luke's gospel is constantly subverting that hierarchy of power and privilege and reminding us that God doesn't operate that way at all. And that's exactly what Mary's song is about. Mary's song starts out about her own experience of knowing God's favor on her. But then the song quickly turns into a condemnation of the world as it is and a prophetic announcement of what God will make the world to be. She sings, "He has shown strength with his arm. He has scattered the proud in the thoughts of their hearts. He has brought down the powerful from their thrones and lifted up the lowly. He has filled the hungry with good things and sent the rich away empty." You know, as I read that, I wonder just how Mary came to some of those conclusions. Like an angel comes to Mary and says, "You're going to have a baby." And Mary stands up and says, "God has surely sent the rich away empty." It almost seems like a non sequitur. And after all, when Jesus is born, it is poor Mary and Joseph who are sent away empty into the stables to have their baby there. And the rich in that moment seem to be doing just fine. The powerful were still on their thrones. By the way, the Greek word for powerful could also be translated as rulers. This is not just an abstract term. This is a political point Mary is making because she was actually surrounded by real rulers on real thrones, really making her life miserable. Just a few verses before this, Luke mentions Herod, who is the ruler of that area at the time. And just a few verses after this, Luke mentions Caesar Augustus, who was really the most powerful leader in the history of the world and who would make her life very miserable. He would force Mary from her home while she was very pregnant with his decree for taxation. And Caesar's taxes did not go to fund social services for the common good. They were mostly to fuel his wars and pad his wealth. And 2,000 years later, there are still horrible rulers directing expensive and unjust wars, and the rich have still not really been sent away empty. By all accounts, they're richer than ever. And so Mary's song, in a way, only makes sense if Mary is speaking beyond herself. She's exercising her prophetic imagination. She's speaking against the world as it is, and she's announcing the world as God wants it to be. And I don't think it's a coincidence that this song happens at Elizabeth's house. And in the verse right before Mary, you know, spits these bars, Elizabeth has spoken a blessing over Mary and acknowledged the favor that she sees in Mary. And so I think that's such a cool example of one woman helping another woman step into her prophetic calling. Encouragement, we can give encouragement with our words to others that puts courage in our bones, because it takes courage to question the existing order of this world. It takes courage to stand up and call forth a better order. And Mary sees what God has done with her, how God has acted towards her. And she in this moment courageously stands up and she declares that this is emblematic of who God is, of what God cares about, of what God is up to in the world, even if that defies the way that the world still seems to be. She sees that what God has done for her in her lowliness is what God is up to, and what he is doing for Israel in their lowliness, and is what God is up to for the lowly people of this world. Now, one question that has caught people up a little bit with this passage is the question of, you know, is Mary just describing what God is going to do, or is she encouraging people like us to bring about this great reversal, right? So, for example, one commentator I read said, Mary's song is not a revolutionary call to human action, but a celebration of God's action. Now, before I dismiss that idea too quickly, it's worth noting that this is a passage about what God does. It's about what God is like, and that alone is encouraging to us. The gospel is good news about God, and the good news about God that we learn from this passage is that God is on the side of the lowly, and he has a plan to turn things around. And this is good news for us in a world where we seem to be so tragically incapable of turning ourselves around. I felt this very deeply last week. I watched a cell phone video that was online from Oxford High School in Michigan, where students were hiding in a classroom, and you heard a voice coming from the door where the shooter, who was an active shooter in the school, he was impersonating a sheriff. And he was saying, you know, open the door, I'm a sheriff. And the students didn't open the door, they escaped through the window. But what truly struck me and really made me weep as I watched this video was the way that they analyzed this situation with such a level-headed calm. Like, this was an expected situation. This was something that they trained for. This is just something that comes with the territory of being a high school student in America. One student at that moment says to the voice at the door, says, we're just not willing to take that risk right now. These children have been put in a position where they have to assess risks and gamble with their lives. And they've just accepted this unfathomable situation as the brutal normal, because this is the reality we've given them to live in. And I don't see an end to it. We seem to be incapable of turning ourselves around. And there are moments like that where you just get hit with the weight of the helplessness of the situation we're in that should cause our souls to cry out, oh, that God would rend the heavens and come down. So yes, it is good news of the Advent story that God is a God who acts in the middle of our inaction, in our inability. He's a God who does what we cannot do. He's a God who breaks in with a virgin birth. One thing I love about the virgin birth, man had nothing to do with that at all. God is at play. So part of the posture of Advent is reminding ourselves there are things only God can do. We are waiting on him, even as Mary waited with a defiant and expectant hope that he will act. He will cast down the mighty. He will destroy the destroyers of this world. But I would not be so hasty to say that Mary's song is not a revolutionary call to human action, just a celebration of God. If for centuries, the lowly people of this world have heard hope in this song that has stirred them up to action for good reason. Yes, this is about what God cares about and who God is. But here's the thing. Whenever God tells us what he cares about, we're meant to care about that too. Yes, this is a song about what God is up to. But whenever God tells us what he's up to, go ahead and consider that an invitation to get on board. Because the way that God does stuff is through people, and especially overlooked and discounted people. So Advent is a time where we wait on God, but also as we await his coming, we live out what we know to be the priorities of his kingdom. And Mary spells out for us what God cares about, what his priorities are here, if we have ears to hear them. So I do think it's a call to action. There's a good reason that in the past century, at least three different governments have banned the public recitation of this text, considering the message too revolutionary. And there are many ways to participate in God's work of lifting up the lowly. For my wife and I, one of the things that we've done, this has been a driving factor for our involvement in the foster system. I know Melissa talks a lot about L'Arche, and that would be a powerful way to be involved with God's work. They're a community built on the belief that people with disabilities who are often thought as useless by the world are actually exceedingly precious to God. And I think if we're to believe the scriptures here, God actually has a preference for people who are lowly in the eyes of the world. This passage has God taking sides, and it should prompt us to ask ourselves, whose side am I on? When God does his work of scattering the proud and lifting the lowly and the dust settles, where will I be standing? Who will I be standing with? The irony is not lost on me that a white, cishet, relatively well-off male is preaching this text about God being on the side of the lowly. I must personally not dodge the force of this text. It would be easy to do so. It would be very easy for me to just assume that I'm not the proud or the rich or the powerful, the one that could use a little bit of scattering and emptying and being kicked off of a throne. But maybe that's exactly who I am. And if so, this text would still be good news for me. And if that's you, this text is still good news for you, because the gospel, the good news, is good news for the rich and the poor alike, but it's not received in exactly the same way. God does, in fact, treat different people differently. And over again, he seems to have a different message to the poor than to the rich, but both of them are good news if we have ears to hear it. The Brazilian theologian Leonardo Boff wrote, "God flings the proud of heart to the earth in the hope that they will be delivered from their ridiculous vaunting and flaunting, to become free and obedient children of God and brothers and sisters to others." See, when we choose our riches and our pride and our thrones, we would actually be missing out on the truly good life, on the kingdom blessings of the beloved community. Clinging to our superiority keeps us from experiencing the deepest forms of love. And so this song tells us what God does, but also what we must do. And here's the other part of the good news. In calling us to get off of our thrones and let go of our riches, God is not asking us to do something that he has not already done. The greatest reversal in all of history is right here, the incarnation. God came down to the dirt, down to the manger, down to the cross. The eternal Son of God became human only to be marred even beyond human likeness. Only to be denied even basic human dignity in death. The theologian James Cone wrote powerfully of the way that the cross is a comforting image to lowly people who've experienced injustice and arbitrary violence. He said, "The God of Jesus's cross is found among the least, among the crucified people of the world." So the question this text prompts in me is, when he returns, where will we be found? Among the least with Jesus and Mary? We can either be cast from our thrones, or like Christ, we can consider our thrones not something to be grasped onto. We will either be sent away empty, or like Christ, we can empty ourselves. Choose you this day. Amen.